Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 28, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing recent developments in the unfolding story at the IRS. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note, as always, that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're very happy to welcome back to our program Chapman Law School Professor and Dean Emeritus John Eastman. Professor Eastman, Dean Eastman is also the chairman of the Federalist Society Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. And if I've got it right, John, I think you're the chairman of the board of the National Organization for Marriage.
That's correct.
And this is one of the groups that's involved in the story with the IRS. So Dean Eastman is here not only as a legal expert, but as a somewhat involved party, I suppose, as the story unfolds. So he's going to give us some opening remarks, maybe some 15 to 20 minutes, describing recent developments and, I suppose, the road forward. And then we will turn to the audience members for questions. So we've got a lot of folks on the phone already. Be prepared with your questions. We'll get to those questions after the opening remarks by Dean Eastman. With that, Dean Eastman, please go right ahead.
Well, thanks very much, Dean, and to the Federal Society for hosting another, I think, terrific topic on the teleforum. I'm delighted to be participating, and thank you all for joining. Obviously, this has hit above the fold in even the major East Coast papers in the country, the Washington Post and New York Times, as well as everywhere else, and talk radio and television broadcast. It's crossed the line from Fox News over to the other networks as well. The main story has been the slow walking of the conservative Tea Party group's applications for 501c4 status, which is a nonprofit status, as many of you probably know, that allows for participation in political matters as long as that doesn't predominate the group's mission. So the kind of 50% rule there. Unlike a 501c3 that is not allowed to participate in explicit partisan campaign activity at all. The donations to 501c4s are not tax deductible, but any income that they make off of their general activities is not taxable, so it's that nonprofit status. And they were slow-walked, which meant that many of them were constrained from participating fully in the political process. And, of course, a lot of the attention has been focused on that slow-walking and who knew what when. I'm going to add to that mix a piece of this story that I think is even more egregious and has not gotten as much publicity as the 501c4 slow walking. And that's the actions that were taken against the National Organization for Marriage, which, as Dean pointed out, is an organization on which I serve as chairman of the board. The National Organization of Marriage is a 501c4, and it was approved back in 2008 with that status. So we're not part of the slow-walking story, at least on the 501c4. There may be a 501c3 parallel story with our education foundation that fits within the slow-walking. But what happened to the National Organization for Marriage, or NOM, as I'll refer to them throughout the rest of the call, is back in March of 2012, a copy of our tax return was posted on the website of the Human Rights Campaign, which is the principal political opponent of NOM in the nationwide fights for traditional marriage. 501c4s are required to make public their 990 tax forms. But a portion of those tax forms, particularly the accompanying Schedule B, which includes the list of donors and their addresses, are as private and confidential as your own personal 1040 tax returns. And it is a felony for anybody at the IRS to disclose those tax returns, and a further felony for anybody knowing that the tax returns are confidential to further disseminate them or even to inspect them. And it's a rather serious felony. It's a felony punishable by up to $5,000 fine and up to 5 years in prison. And so these tax returns are posted, including the Schedule B, was posted on the Human Rights Campaign's website. it was posted as a PDF file, and it had some redactions on it. And our computer technicians were able to remove the redaction layer. And side warning for anybody that doesn't know, you can do that on PDFs. Be careful. but you can remove the redaction layers on PDF if they're created in a certain unsophisticated way. And we were able to do that and discovered once the layer was removed, what the underlying original document showed. And it was stamped with internal Bates stamp coding from the Internal Revenue Service intake computer itself. Those documents only exist once they are filed with the IRS. So anybody, unless they obtained a copy from the IRS of their own tax return, which seems a little odd that anybody would do, those documents had to originate within the IRS. That happened on March 2012. Now, the reason timing is so significant is, of course, the Human Rights Campaign had been trying for a long time to get our list of donors so that they can post it on the website and harass and intimidate people who are donating to causes that support traditional marriage. The head of the Human Rights Campaign was Joseph Solomnese, who shortly before this public disclosure of our tax returns had become a national co-chairman of the Obama re-election campaign. We filed in April of 2012 a request for investigation, both with the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, TIGDA, Mr. George. That's the same group that published the report on the slow-walking 501c4 issue that generated so much publicity over the last 2 weeks. We also filed a request for investigation with the Department of Justice because of the underlying felonious conduct that occurred here. The Department of Justice declined to take up the matter, saying it's a tax issue, and we did get confirmation that there was an investigation underway over at the Treasury Inspector General's office. The initial stages of that investigation, however, questioned NOM officials to try and prove that the documents were leaked by somebody within internal to the National Organization of Marriage, and therefore that nobody at IRS had any wrongdoing. When we pointed out that it was in fact an internal IRS document that had been leaked, that was the last we heard of the investigation. So beginning last summer, we don't know whether the investigation is concluded, whether anybody who committed this felony was identified, or whether in fact any actions were taken. Federal law requires that if a taxpayer return is disclosed illegally, that the taxpayer be notified once an indictment or charges are brought against the perpetrator, and NOM has received no such notification. So beginning in August of last year, NOM began filing a series of Freedom of Information Act requests, both with the Treasury Inspector General's office and with the IRS directly. Responses to these FOIA requests are a case study in government obfuscation on how they avoid Freedom of Information Act. The first round, the IRS said, those documents are under the jurisdiction of TIGDA, therefore we don't have to disclose anything to you. And when we pointed out we weren't asking for documents over at TIGDA, we were asking for documents at the IRS, the IRS responded by saying, you don't get to bring multiple requests. We've already responded to that request. So finally we filed early this year a request for TIGDA specifically asking for the information that the federal statutes authorize us to request. Confirmation that there was an investigation underway, its status, whether it had proved successful or unsuccessful, and what actions were taken, if any, if once any possible appeal rights had run against the perpetrator. And I have to say that on the Orwellian scale in responses, this letter that we got from the Department of Treasury Office of Inspector General on May 3rd of this year, it really takes the cake. The claim is that the identity of the perpetrator can't be disclosed to us, the taxpayer against whom the felony was committed, because Title 26, that's the IRS code, Section 6103, the very statute that protects the confidentiality of your tax returns, includes the confidentiality of any investigations conducted for violating, provisions of the IRS. So if you're a taxpayer in you're being investigated. They can't disclose that either. Well, the IRS is interpreting that language about investigations for violations of the IRS code as including their investigation for violations of the disclosure rules against the taxpayer that protects the identity of the person who perpetrated this felony against the taxpayer, and therefore it can't be disclosed. A perfectly Orwellian governmental response to shield the person who committed this felony. One other set of legal issues here, and then I'll turn back to the slow walking on the 501c4 legal issues. Civil penalties against the United States are also available, civil cause of action against any government employee who illegally discloses tax returns. And those are $1,000 per disclosure or per inspection of the illegally disclosed tax return. And NAM has announced publicly that they will be filing before month's end or shortly thereafter a lawsuit availing themselves of the civil liability provisions. Of course, NAM cannot be the one that brings criminal charges against it. That would be up to the Department of Justice. An interesting part of the statute, though, is it also provides for civil penalties against any person other than government officials who have disclosed in violation of the tax rules. But court interpretations have limited that to actual subcontractors who had legal access to the tax returns in the first place, not to subsequent third parties who act in collusion with the IRS leaker and then further disseminate it. And so under current interpretation and approved by several of the courts of appeals, the IRS individual who leaked this document could be responsible for the United States being held liable for a single disclosure. But the fact that it was put up on a website that received millions of hits would not be a million further disclosures, nor would the subsequent disclosure non-governmental party be liable civilly under the current interpretation of that statute. So it's one thing that Congress might want to be looking at is, was that the proper interpretation of the statute? They could be held liable for a felony if the Department of Justice chose to prosecute, but can't be held civilly liable to the individual taxpayer. And so those are some of the issues swirling up right now on the disclosure cases. And by the way, I've focused on National Organization for Marriage because that's the one I'm most familiar with, but it appears from news accounts that there were similar illegal disclosures of tax return information, information that had been submitted to the IRS for 501c4 status requests that was submitted early to the website ProPublica, and those would violate the same felony provisions by giving that information because it was not authorized to provide that information under the IRS code, and also the same civil liability provisions holding the United States accountable, but not ProPublica for further dissemination of that. So that's the set of issues on the disclosure side. On the slow walking side, there's nothing that is specifically any of the code provisions that specifically deal with the issue of slow walking, but there are a couple of generic federal statutes that look to have been violated here. And here, for this portion of it, I'm relying on a very good summary of potential criminal violations that might have occurred on the slow walking that was prepared by my good friends John Malcolm and Hans von Spakovsky over at the Heritage Foundation and circulated about a week or two ago. I'm sure it's still up on the Heritage Foundation website if you want to look at that. But they both have done criminal work in the Department of Justice, and so I think they've got a very good handle on the more generic criminal prosecutions that might be brought. They include a provision of the tax code, section 7214, makes it a criminal offense, punishable by termination of employment, a fine of up to $250,000, and imprisonment of not more than 5 years for any officer or employee of the United States who, with intent to defeat the application of any provision of the Internal Revenue Code, fails to perform any of the duties of his office or employment. And it would seem that deliberate delays based on political views of these organizations might well fit within that specific provision of the tax code. And then even more generic, of course, Section 241 of Title 18, conspiracy against the exercise of constitutional rights. It appears that the right of freedom of association, freedom of speech, even freedom to engage in the political process may have been targeted with these particular groups, and that would be a violation of Section 241. Deprivation of rights under color of law, Section 242 of Title 18, and then the series of statements to Congress and to investigators would, of course, violate Section 1001 of Title 18 of the U.S. Code, the general prohibition against false statements and testimony. And so I think that there are a number of statements that have been given to Congress at the hearings, both here in the last 2 weeks as well as over the course of the last year, that might put some people running afoul of that provision. And I think that may be what has led to now the recent claims of claiming the right against self-incrimination. Let me close with talking about that Fifth Amendment right and the issue on whether or not Ms. Lerner, who testified before the House of Representatives last week, waived her Fifth Amendment rights. Obviously, if she'd gotten up in a trial courtroom and made a statement or testified about the particular subject matter and then sought to claim her Fifth Amendment rights, not to be questioned about the veracity of her initial statement, she would have been deemed to waive those rights. It's a closer call when you're not in a trial situation. For example, the parallel here is not so much the trial courtroom, but a grand jury courtroom where you can get up and testify. And then if a question moves you into an area where if you answer, you would be incriminating yourself, you're allowed to claim at that point the Fifth Amendment right without having waived it by your prior testimony. And that turns on how closely related the subject matter of what you're now being asked about is to what you'd already spoken about. And generally, testimony in Congress kind of fits that model. And so the question is whether her fairly generic disclaimer of any criminal conduct at the beginning is close enough in detail to the subject matter that she was going to be asked to testify about as to whether or not that initial opening statement constituted a waiver. And like I say, it's a close call. It would play out most likely by Congress calling her back up, saying that we believe that you've waived your Fifth Amendment right. We insist that you answer these questions. She will undoubtedly then stand on her Fifth Amendment claim in response to each of those questions. Then it'll be up to Congress to decide whether to seek a contempt of Congress sanctions against her based on the claim that she had waived, and then that would be sorted out whether the initial statement constituted a waiver. So that's kind of as dispassionately as I can look at these things, what some of the underlying criminal as well as civil liability statutes are, what some of the lawsuits that will be going forward will be based on. Act Right Legal Foundation, which is representing NAM in its putting together its case, filed a lawsuit on behalf of True the Vote last week on the slow walking issues and raising a number of the civil liability claims and seeking an injunction to get their nonprofit status. And a number of other suits are in the works on behalf of a number of the other 501c4 prospective organizations that were slow walked through the IRS during the course of a couple of years here. So that's the kind of overview lay of the land. And Dean, why don't we open it up to questions if we have any?
I'm sure we will. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement. We'll say the floor mode is on. After that, as always, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So stand by. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Dean John Eastman, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got over 150 people on the call, so I imagine we'll have a number of questions to roll through here. We've got about 40 minutes left, so let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we can address what kinds of reforms might be made, especially legislative reforms, to avoid having this kind of situation come up in the future. Congress actually did make 501c4s taxable, if they engaged in support for or opposition to candidates for elected office. But, and the language of the statute made it exclusively that they not do so, but the IRS came involved and it interpreted as more than half, at least by their practices. And what is taxable is either the amount spent for campaign activity or the revenue from investments, whichever is less. But the tax can be avoided by simply disclosing the donors, which turns the 501c4 into a 527. Now, it seems that one remedy would be to remove the taxability of 501c4s under any circumstances and find another way to deal with the problem of disclosure of donors if that is what Congress wants to do and finds a way to do so contrary to Citizens United.
Yeah, very good question, John. There's several issues kind of flurrying around in that, and let me take up several of them. First of all, I think the Citizens United overlay seeking to force disclosure of donors, because the Supreme Court has previously allowed disclosure of donors, and they're trying to limit political expenditures. Not by mere disclosure of donors, by what happens once donors are disclosed. And we saw it happening in the Proposition 8 campaign with the vengeance. We saw it happening in the Washington ballot initiative campaign. And it was the subject of the Doe versus Reed case in the Supreme Court a couple years ago, where the donors are disclosed and then harassed in their business and their private property and their families and whatever in order to be intimidated against making donations. And this is starting to skew the political process. And I think at some point we're going to have to grapple with the NAACP versus Alabama and socialist workers issue about whether these donor disclosures are being used for illicit rather than legitimate purposes. And I think we're going to have to find a greater protection of donors in any of the hot button issues where they're likely to be harassed and therefore intimidated away from participating into the political process and exercising their constitutional rights. And you know, modern computer technology has exacerbated this problem. You know, 50 years ago when the campaign finance system was originally put together, I could pull a report and see what kind of people were donating to a particular candidate. That helped me understand who the candidate was, and that was useful information for me to decide whether I should vote for that candidate or not. But now I don't sort by candidate. I can sort by individual, donor, and I can build a profile on you, who you've donated. I can pull it up easily. If you're coming in for a job application, I can decide whether I don't like your politics or not. I can do all sorts of things that I didn't used to be able to do. And the focus has shifted away from avoiding quid pro quo corruption of candidates to profiling donors, either to take other actions against them, to sub silentio, impose conditions on the exercise of their civil and constitutional rights, or quite frankly, outright intimidate them from and prevent them from participating in the political process at all. So I do think we have to take that up. The 501c4s, as I understand it, that yes, the amount you spend in the political process is taxable. Your other activities are not. And as long as you stay under a 50% threshold, you still have that non-taxable aspect to your organization, and that's rather significant, particularly because of the educational functions and all of the non-express advocacy that these groups can do to try and influence opinion of their federal citizens, even if it's not tied to direct electoral outcomes. And that's one of the reasons why the 501c4s are there in the first place. And so I do think, whether we ought to have 501c4s or not, is a different question. If we're going to have them, as we do, then the rules need to be applied faithfully and even-handedly across the political spectrum. The notion that it's only the Tea Party groups or groups that say we're here to defend the Constitution are somehow against the public interest, but the myriad of groups on the left side of the political spectrum that use exactly the same nonprofit structure to engage in their activities are within the public good. That's where the real danger here, and given to the government, is basically giving them the power to put the thumb on the scale in the political debate that they are supposed to be accountable to rather than supervising.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button to ask a question of our expert today, Dean John Eastman. We'll get to our next caller momentarily. Before we do that, I want to announce and invite listeners to go to the Federalist Society's website, not only to check on a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls, but you'll see there on the front page of the website an announcement of our upcoming conference held in conjunction with the Federalist Society's Executive Branch Review Project. It's a conference that will be hosted on June 11th here in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club from about 9 o'clock in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon. A number of different panels looking at all aspects of activities in the federal executive branch. CLE credits will be available. Registration is open. Again, go to the front page of the Federalist Society website for more information. We've got a number of callers lined up today talking about what's happening at the IRS. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Paul Avalar from the Institute for Justice in Arizona. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about the process of slow walking, specifically the sorts of inquiries, the horribly intrusive inquiries that the IRS was making of these groups, and whether or not anything had happened like that in regards to NOM.
Not in regards to NOM, but in regards to True the Vote, and it's in our complaint. And while I'm talking here, I'll try and pull up the complaint so I can give you some of the specific allegations that were in there. But generally, with a number of the groups, things like do you pray at your meetings? Do you say the Pledge of Allegiance? What kind of books have you been reading? Have you ever met with the so-and-so other people? Do you have any plans for running for political office at some point in the future? Who are your donors to your organization? Now, the donors have to be disclosed eventually anyway once you become a 501c4, but only disclosed to the IRS, not beyond that. Using the trigger of who your donors are to try and decide, well, are those donors that are famous and known for giving to conservative causes, then we will slow walk or not give the nonprofit status. Is Charles Koch and the other Koch brothers on that list? What have you? Those are the kind of things that really raise troubling questions about your free speech rights, your freedom of association, and making it a condition that you meet some kind of preconceived government notion of who's appropriate to be getting this and who's not. So that's kind of one set of issues. The other set of issues, and this has come out publicly as well with some of the organizations, that all of a sudden the individuals that had sought not, it created a small Tea Party group of 10 or 15 people, all of a sudden start finding their small businesses or their personal tax returns audited. They start finding out that they're getting visits from the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms folks or from OSHA. Now, maybe it's all coincidental, but the timing of it suggests that there may have been some coordination between the office of the IRS that was reviewing these applications and government enforcement agencies. And of course, disclosure of those things, there's nothing evident in the applications of the 501c4s that would suggest that there was any criminal activity. And so it starts looking like these other investigations were designed to intimidate or people from engaging in the political process. I suspect be a violation of the non-disclosure rules, because I don't think it fits within one of the authorized exceptions for law enforcement for the disclosures. And so there would be felonies committed by the referral of that information over to the ATF, for example, and then the ATF acting on that information to go conduct an investigation of somebody in order to harass them. So you got these you got these informational things, and then you've got these use of other law enforcement agencies without any particular probable cause that it was any crime committed, but now looks more like harassment. Now, obviously, those are some of the allegations that come to mind based on the news stories that are out there. You'd want to investigate a lot more detail to find out whether there was something that triggered a legitimate law enforcement response or not. But on its face, it doesn't appear that there was any legitimate purpose for those subsequent investigations. And it's deeply troubling and deeply chilling on the exercise of core First Amendment speech and political rights for that kind of activity to have occurred.
Okay, once again, if you have a question for Dean John Eastman, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
John, can you hear me? Lou Cordia.
Hi, Lou. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Do you have any idea of how many conservative groups have been targeted and then how many federal agencies have been involved, like, you know, the IRS, OSHA, EPA, FBI, ATF, and others?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to either one of those other than what I've been able to glean from the news accounts. And I think I've seen mention of a couple of dozen specific groups and suggestions that there may be hundreds of groups that fit within the same model. I think that information is still coming out, and I confess, dealing with all the media on this last week, I was not able to watch as much of the detail of the hearings last week, both in the Senate and in the House, and some of that additional information may already be out there. Other people on this call may know more specifically. Now, on the other side, how many agencies were involved? Well, obviously, we know we got the IRS involved. On the disclosure issues, we've got the Treasury Inspector General's office involved, which conducted the investigation that it now won't acknowledge whether it existed or not. The one news account that I've seen that included FBI, ATF, and OSHA investigations would suggest there are at least three other agencies involved, and probably generally the Department of Justice, which oversees two of those. So you know, there's a pretty serious handful of law enforcement agencies that might be implicated in this thing based on the news accounts we've seen thus far.
Very chilling. Thanks, John.
Yes.
All right, let's go to our next caller.
This whole thing has reminded me of things I've heard from defense attorneys, that you never want to take on a prosecutor because he has unlimited funds and pretty much an unlimited support staff supporting him. I'm just starting to wonder how big – when does it get to the point where the IRS is so big, the regulations are so Byzantine that really it becomes almost impossible to provide adequate oversight for them? Because it really makes me wonder what else is going on that this took so long to come to the fore. Are the independent groups big enough? Are they well supported enough to be able to watch what is going on?
No. You know, I don't know where that line is, but I will tell you that it was crossed a long time ago. There is not a single person in the country that cannot be the subject of an investigation of the IRS, and I have no doubt that if I were to focus on anybody on this call or anybody else and bring all the resources to bear, that you've probably not violated, you know, one or more of the IRS rules. You've probably not violated one or more of the federal over-criminalization statutes. That's why I think Ed Meese and the shop over at Heritage are focusing so much on over-criminalization. We have now created a system where I can decide to go after any individual and find a crime rather than beginning with the crime and then find out who committed it. And remember, I'll never forget a conversation I had back in the 1970s with somebody who was on an exchange visiting from the Soviet Union and said, the Soviet Union has greater protections in their constitution for rights than we have in ours. I suggest that you're never prosecuted for exercising your rights. You're prosecuted for buying meat on the black market because that's the only way you can eat. You're not being prosecuted for exercising your rights here. You're being prosecuted for violating one of these, you know, Byzantine provisions of the IRS code or the OSHA codes or what have you. And it just so happened that we picked you because we didn't like the way you were exercising your constitutional rights. This is a very great danger, it seems to me. And I think this story has kind of highlighted it for many Americans in a way that had not been on the front burner before.
Yeah, I think the woman from the True the Vote, what I found so incredible, and I haven't heard a lot of people bring it up, is that it wasn't just the IRS. The labor relations, the FBI, I mean, somebody beyond the IRS had to be coordinating that. For all of them to go after her at the same time, you know, it seems that the machinery of government can be set in motion quite cryptically in the background without us being able to figure out who it was.
No, that's right. That's right. And look, you know, if you look at this as a, you know, kind of partisan divide between Democrats and Republicans, you know, that's bad enough. But when you look at it as a big government versus limited government fight, when the government is weighing in using the powers of government to kind of block people that would challenge the very legitimacy of government in whole aspects of its thing, you know, that's a thumb on the scale of the democratic process being leveled or placed by, you know, the biggest partisan on that fight, which is the government itself. And it's a very dangerous thing to both the notion of limited government, but also to the notion of democratic self-governance.
Thanks very much. This is a great discussion.
Thank you, Dean Eastman. We've got three more callers in line right now. If you'd like to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, Stephen Casey with the Texas Center for Defensive Life. I guess one of the questions I've had is I've heard you mention a lot about C4s and not as much on C3s, and I think the second question I have is, what's normal as far as how long it should take? Because our 501c3 is a pro-life litigation firm, and it took us 13 months. And I've heard some people cleared it as much as 4. So is that a slow walkthrough to go 13 months? I just don't know because there's no standard out there.
I think it is a slow walk. My understanding is the norm is between 3 and 9 months. And so if you're at the 13-month period, there may be something nefarious going on as well there. And there wouldn't surprise me at all to learn that there is, given the title of your organization.
Yeah, that's one question.
You know, and so let me go back on for all the other groups that are dealing with this. What I would recommend is that you get in touch with Act Right Legal Foundation, or you can send me a note, contact Dean Reuter at Federal Society. He can get you to me. And you know, let's start setting up a series of Freedom of Information Act requests, put the timeline together, try and ascertain what was going on with your particular application, whether 501c4 or even more egregiously, it seems to me, 501c3, if they're doing this over on that front as well, and I suspect they are. I think that's the issue we're having with the NOM Education Fund as well. And then let's, you know, get the administrative steps taken to set up the lawsuit challenge if it comes to that, and get more information about how broad this is, particularly if you've got a group that all of a sudden for the first time the individuals that submitted the application are getting their own individual tax returns audited, or they're getting OSHA visits to their, you know, small workplace or what have you, and demonstrate that level of coordination it both exacerbates the criminal and civil liability, but it also, I think, really elevates what's going on here to show that it's just not a couple of individual employees, but that there's some more systematic process in place to coordinate this and to implement a strategy to prevent political opposition.
We've still got a number of callers on the line. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Leo Dombrowski in Chicago. Professor Eastman, I've got a couple questions on the True the Vote case, in which employees at the IRS were named also in their individual capacities. If they were to be found liable in their individual capacities, would that really make any difference to them? I assume that they will be provided a defense and an indemnity by either their union or their employer. So question number one, does it make any difference to them that they're named in an individual capacity? And question number two is, does naming people individually help at all with the discovery process? Does it broaden the scope at all? Does it make any difference in that respect?
I don't think it makes any difference on the scope of discovery, but I'm not an expert on this aspect of government employment liability law, but from the parallel situation I've had on a couple of litigations here in California under state law, some individual capacity suits, because the theory for them is by taking certain actions, you have gone beyond the scope of your authority, and that what you did was therefore not acting under color of law, where you would get the immunities that normally attach, that you might be held personally liable. And I suspect that that's part of what's going on in the True the Vote complaint as well. Let me reiterate, though, that that's not my particular area of expertise, and so there may be either people on this line or others that know the answer to that better than I do.
Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. We have one question left, and then our lines will be open. Let's go to what for now is our final question.
This is Manny Klausner calling of Reason Foundation. John, I appreciate your calm and patient discussion of what you've experienced so far. I was wondering if you've given any thought to the possibility of a cause of action, presumably in federal court, maybe even, I don't know if there's an immunity problem in state court, under First Amendment, and if we go in state court under a right of privacy provision, say the state constitution in California, does that seem like, it seems to me you've outlined enough for a prima facie case, you get the benefits of discovery. If you get a sympathetic judge, you get a whole new forum to further develop information and get some coverage for this.
Well, that's a very good question, Manny. Thanks for it. And yes, Judge Posner's decision for the Seventh Circuit on the disclosure issues that said the civil liability provisions of the tax code cannot extend to third parties who subsequently republish confidential tax returns because the civil liability provision is limited to those who had authority to have the tax returns in the first place. But he does say, so unless there are some causes of action under state law, that civil liability door is closed. And so he kept open the possibility of state law. And I think violating the First Amendment the state comparable parallel provisions or various rights of privacy might well be implicated. The damage issues and a number of other things have to be fully developed. But of course, we have not closed the door on any of those avenues. I do think, though, that bringing a civil action against the United States for the initial disclosure would yield discovery that we have of information that we have as yet unsuccessfully sought to obtain through the Freedom of Information Act process that will identify who and what level of collaboration or collusion were involved, and that would help you then identify whether somebody did something knowingly or grossly negligently or completely inadvertently, not knowing that having been given these forms by an IRS official, that they were not legally allowed to have them or to even to inspect them.
So what do you think that – so at what point, I realize you're leaving the door open, it seems to me this might be an intriguing earlier step rather than a later step.
Well, it is. There's one other, it seems to me, limitation or concern that may block that, and that is – and I'm drawing a blank on the case name right now, but you remember the Supreme Court half a dozen years ago or so, an internal phone conversation was illegally recorded and then leaked to the press, and an action was taken against the member of the press that further disclosed it. And it was held that even though it was illegally obtained and he knew it, he was not the one that committed the crime in illegally intercepting the communication. And therefore, once he was given it, it was free in the public domain. And so there are First Amendment protections on the other side that have to be explored very carefully. And that's why I think understanding the level of collusion before you consider going after the third-party non-governmental actors might be important to take that First Amendment potential defense away.
Okay, and declaratory relief was one of the thoughts I had as far as setting it up.
Right. No, that's very good. And by the way, Dean, if I may, somebody earlier in the call had asked, you know, how can any of these groups possibly compete with all of the unlimited resources of the federal government and the prosecution forces? A very good question, and I meant to answer it earlier.
Hey, John, before you go into that, let me just tell you you've hit a nerve somewhere. So we've got still now four questions pending, but go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So obviously, Act Right Legal Foundation is a nonprofit legal foundation that's taken the lead on bringing these cases. You can go to Act Right. You can give them information about potential cases you have. You can also help them in their fundraising efforts to underwrite the cost of this litigation. On NOM's case in particular, you can make that donation directly to NOM. The co-counsel on the True the Vote case is the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which I head, and so you can visit the Claremont Institute website, claremont.org, and make donations to that litigation fund there as well. So there are lots of ways people can help. We're never going to get close to evening the scales on this, but at least we can get into the realm where we're David in the arena with Goliath and able to break these cases and make some of this stuff stick.
All right, we've got four questions now. People are lighting up the lines. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, John, Larry Callahan. Enjoyed your presentation. My knowledge may be a bit out of date. However, with respect to the question on the consequences for someone involved in this, irrespective of someone paying your fine or penalty, it would seem to me, particularly if you're in like IRS intelligence or some other area, it could very much impact either new or continued security clearances. That's not the type of thing that the government likes to see in your background when they're granting those clearances. Because one, it's about leaking, it's about improper use of information, and that might have some impact there. It certainly would 20 years ago.
Right. No, that's very good. And I point out, whatever their civil liability is or may not be, if they illegally disclose confidential tax returns, that's a felony, and they can be held personally liable for the felony for a $5,000 fine and up to 5 years in prison. And I suspect the 5 years in prison ought to scare a number of people.
But that assumes this attorney general would have one of his U.S. attorneys prosecute, although a long statute of limitations.
That's right. And,
5 years.
Yeah, 5 years. And quite frankly, if this attorney general won't, I think, remember, the illegal use of the IRS for political purposes is one of the charges that have been brought, that have been drafted, one of the articles of impeachment that have been drafted against President Nixon. And particularly with the NOM case, when you've got, beyond just a slow walking, you've got deliberate commission of felonies by IRS officials, this is what what the evidence strongly suggests right now. You've got those felonies committed by disclosure of those tax returns to a national co-chair of the presidential reelection campaign. You're now talking about not a couple people down in some cubbyhole that came up with this all by themselves, but you're talking about rather high-level people, at least close enough to be implicated in knowledge of this, if not in the outright direction of it.
All right, let's take another question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. This discussion seems to point to a negative consequence of the Department of Justice having seized exclusive authority to prosecute criminal cases with the collusion of the courts. And perhaps it may be time to revive the traditional practice of private criminal prosecutions, or at least to greatly augment the office of a special prosecutor. And secondly, although the courts have allowed criminal prosecution of federal actors under 18 U.S.C. 241 and 242, those acts were actually authorized by the 14th Amendment only against state actors. And there is actually no provision in the U.S. Constitution that provides Congress with authority to criminally prosecute federal actors other than to remove them from office, after which they could presumably be prosecuted under state law.
Right. No, that's a problem. The Bivens actions that are available against federal actors solve that problem in some measure, but not entirely. I also think with the IRS tax return disclosures, it's one of the reasons Congress provided a civil remedy to the taxpayer against the people that illegally disclose their tax returns. And the fact that statute has now been interpreted to preclude civil liability by non-governmental actors unless they're a subcontractor that had, like they're fixing the computers at the IRS and they get somebody's return and disclose it, you can go after them civilly. But if the IRS discloses it to a media outlet who then further publishes it and much more broadly publishes it, that civil liability provision is no longer available under current interpretation. And I suspect Congress can fix that with a clarifying amendment to that statute to demonstrate that that was not what was intended. They created the civil liability to prevent just that kind of activity, and I think that would be a step in the right direction. The second thing I think they absolutely have to clarify is absolutely Orwellian interpretation of the statute that prohibits disclosure of confidential tax returns being the same statute that shields the identity of the person that committed the felony in disclosing the tax returns in the first place. And I think Congress can fix that, and it's one of the things that I'm asking the House Oversight and the House Ways and Means Committee to look at as far as statutory adjustments to correct some of the erroneous interpretations that are being given.
John, we've got about 10 minutes left and three questions pending. Let's take our next question.
This is a question for John or Dean. Do you happen to know the breakdown between the applicants seeking C4 status and the existing conservative C4s that have been targeted? Any idea?
This is Dean. I do not. John, do you?
Yeah, I don't know either, and I'm not quite sure what breakdown you're looking for. So the number of C4s that got approved that were conservative versus those that didn't?
Well, we know that there was the slow walking of those applying. The question is, weren't there some existing C4s that were also targeted?
Certainly, NAM is a C4, and it was targeted by the disclosure. So that was, that's kind of a different than slow walking. I don't know, and I've not heard any information about how many other investigations might have been launched into whether you should be able to retain your C4 status, or we're gonna be more we're gonna give you more scrutiny on your C4 than we give to left of center C4s or what have you. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, thanks.
All right. We've got two more questions. I'm going to ask our callers to be short in framing their questions, if they could, brief in framing their questions.
Hi, Professor Eastman. Steve Klein, Wyoming Liberty Group. I just wanted to ask your thoughts on the political or the legal side that a lot of politicians and pundits are kind of using this opportunity to obfuscate and say, well, the IRS was only doing this because the Federal Election Commission or state election commissions aren't doing their job. Do you see that going anywhere?
No, I don't. They're clearly trying to, tie this back to it being all the fault of Citizens United. It's just utter nonsense. And the notion that the American people have to get the permission of government before they can criticize their government has got to be about as anathema to our political democratic process as anything I can conceive of. And yet that's ultimately the root of these attacks on Citizens United. What's happened is a number of organizations that support more limited government are finally finding voice and starting to criticize government and actually be more effective in how they wage their political efforts. And big government is trying to shut that down. And I think we see that playing out with this scandal, and we ought not to let that narrative, get the time of day, and we ought to rebut it every time, particularly because this slow walking started before the Citizens United decision even came down. So, the timeline itself is wrong, but they're trying to shift the focus away from the real scandal here by tying it to another popular cause on the other side, and the facts don't support it, and we ought to just keep articulating the facts and expose this thing on those grounds.
Thank you.
All right. Looks like we've got a final question. Let's go to our last caller.
Yes, with regard to Lerner's exercise of her Fifth Amendment privilege, if that continues to develop as an issue, is that something you imagine the courts would weigh in on, or would they simply say Congress has the authority to decide that issue within the context of a congressional hearing?
Well, I'm not an expert on that particular question either, but let me give my layman's sense of what I think happens. Congress would determine that she is in contempt of Congress. I think they have to submit a request for prosecuting of that contempt to the Department of Justice, is my understanding, which creates all sorts of additional layers of problems. It would probably strengthen the claim seeking for a special prosecutor. But one of the problems with a special prosecutor is a lot of people are just going to say, okay, it's being investigated, we don't have to answer any more questions about it, and it will shut down the investigations in Congress. And I think the Constitution sets out a particular course here when your law enforcement executive officials are themselves implicated, either directly or only one or two steps removed indirectly, in the investigation itself. And Congress then provides a political process to check that. And the political process is one that allows for congressional investigation. And I think one of the things we ought to be exploring is the creation of a select committee, a bipartisan select committee, and instead of all the individual non-lawyer members of Congress or non-prosecutor members of Congress asking their questions and getting their FaceTime on television, hiring an indefatigable and beyond reproach prosecutor to lead the questioning at those hearings. That's, I think, going to be a very important step in actually getting to the truth of this and exposing how the wheels of government, the mechanics of government, are now being used to silence political opposition on the very question of the legitimacy and size and scope of government. And that, I think, is the greatest danger here, that we don't put that genie back in the bottle with some real serious investigation.
Well, Dean Eastman, that sounds almost like a concluding statement. We've exhausted the questions of the audience. We've got a couple minutes left. Do you want to say anything further in terms of wrapping up?
Yeah, let me just say this. When you see these, and everybody on this call can help, there are lots of news stories that are being carried in the local papers where you live. Many of those will try and shift the narrative away from the real scandal that's going on here. I would encourage you to, send corrective letters off to your local newspaper to at least correct the record in that fashion. This is a very serious thing that ought to trouble American citizens across the political spectrum. And the fact that it's not means that only one side's ox is being gored right now. We ought to keep the focus on how dangerous it is to our very democratic institutions if we don't prevent this kind of conduct from happening. And then when you take it the next level, which is the non-disclosure case and actual felonies are being committed, and I think we got to start focusing on how our politics is so degenerated into making it impossible for people even to be willing to stand up and make a donation to the causes they believe in for fear that their businesses and their families will be targeted as a result. And I think we need to expose that. We need to brush off the old Alabama versus NAACP and socialist workers cases. And for the lawyers on the call, make that part of your common parlance in the discussion of these issues, because I think we have crossed that Rubicon, and it's a dangerous one, and we need to be highlighting it.
Thank you very much, Dean Eastman. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Dean John Eastman for participating in our call today. The audience, again, I want to invite you to visit the front page of the Federalist Society's website, where you can find more information about our upcoming June 11th first annual Executive Branch Review Conference and register. That's June 11th here in Washington, D.C. Also consult our website for a schedule of upcoming Teleform conference calls. If the Fisher case comes out on the next court's decision date, which is next Monday, we will very likely have a conference call on that Monday. We're reserving that slot for a discussion of the Fisher case. That's the affirmative action case pending before the court. So do check our schedule for upcoming Teleform conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.